If we have to work to survive, everyone deserves a chance to have a job that fits their skill sets, desires, and strengths, and fulfills them in some capacity.
Jamie McCollum is a professor of sociology at Middlebury College. His first book, Global Unions, Local Power, won the American Sociological Association's prize for the best book on labor. His work has appeared in scholarly journals and popular outlets such as the Washington Post, Mother Jones, and a bunch of others. So in short, Jamie's a sociologist, labor activist, and union activist. I was walking through the airport, even though I already had two or three books on me because I might be a little crazy. I was walking through a bookstore and I stumbled across a book that popped off the shelves titled, Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream. Just standing there, I stumbled across a page and it said this, quote, meaningful work wasn't eroded by high wages. Meaning was introduced to make up for declining wages. In other words, managerial motivation was not a surrogate for meaning, but meaning was a surrogate for money. It was a section that caught my attention, and the chapter was talking about more than just money. And given the moment where we're talking about a labor shortage, given the moment that businesses are fighting back from the global pandemic, given the moment that brands are rethinking their labor strategy, and given the fact that we have a podcast talking about the future of work, I thought I had to talk to Jamie McCollum about this book. It talks about how most Americans have lost control of their work lives. It talks about how some workers are being pushed too long and too hard, how many lack control over their day-to-day work schedule. All these points and many others are things we should be exploring as policymakers, as business leaders, as managers, as employees, as employers, as we think about how we create a future of work that lifts up all workers. I'm not going to spoil this one for you. This was a great one. Jamie McCollum, let's bring it in.
So I guess, Jamie, a good place to start would be if you could share a little bit about yourself and what got you into the line of work that you're in.
Yep. So I'm a sociologist at Middlebury College. I've been here for 10 years. And I used to be a labor activist, union activist. And so I decided I wanted to study that stuff more, from an intellectual scholarly standpoint, I guess. And so I went back to grad school for that. And I wrote a book early on global unionizing. So workers organizing across borders in the same companies, in different countries. I helped do a book on youth unemployment with some other people globally. And then I wrote this recent book called Worked Over, which is on labor time. So in general, I try to marry like scholarly intellectual stuff with sort of an activist background or activist spirit, I guess.
The book is powerful. Our office is in Newark, so obviously I got the book in front of me. The chapter about the sad story about Maria from Newark, New Jersey, was one that like really hit home for us.
Yeah, I mean, I read her story early on, years ago, and was shocked by it. And I wasn't writing the book then, and I forgot about it then, just like everybody else forgot about it. And then in 2019, I was like, oh wait a minute, there's this story out there. And for me, it sort of encapsulates most of what's in the first half of the book, I guess you could say. And so it tends to resonate with people, and I assume that's why the cover has a picture of a car on it in the parking lot. Although I don't know. I mean, I can talk about the story if you want me to, but
yeah. I think the thing that I wanted to talk to you about, even, the book talks, really does a good job at getting you to think about the way that work really is a lot harder on certain folks, primarily come from different backgrounds and different experiences. What do you feel is like the biggest takeaway that, a talent leader listening or a C-level executive today, what's the takeaway you want them to have if they were to read the book?
Um, That's a good question. There's a few things. One is that, yes, to be, you know, there's a world out there that most of us never see. And that's by design, I think. And there's a segment of the working population, which is designated as disposable and sacrificial. During the pandemic, we've seen this. And contrary to what's commonly asserted, they have been increasing their effort and time at work more than anybody else. And so while it's true that high-paid executives, including mostly high-paid white men, tend to work more hours than everybody else, it's ordinary workers who have increased their time the most since in the last 4 or 5 decades. And that shift has mostly been driven to keep up with the rising standard of living. So where people at the top of the income bracket have worked more and get paid more, mostly because of higher compensation, workers at the bottom have tended to work more hours as more or less as a coping mechanism or a survival strategy. And I think, you know, being aware of that is useful.
Yeah, the last, it's wild how over the last year, especially, you know, we went from looking at frontline workers, like many of the stories in your book, talking about workers either in an Amazon center or in restaurants and retail that have been heroes fighting through. And then it's almost like in the last 45 days, it's taken a drastic turn back to sort of some of the things you mentioned in the book that have been largely historical in the way that we've treated workers.
What do you mean the last 45 days? Because of the sort of labor shortage,
yeah,
kind of discourse and stuff?
Yeah, the conversation around, you know, I'd love to get your take on, I just don't understand how a C-level leader can get on Squawk Box and call workers lazy and expect that many of them are going to want to come back and work for them. But that's maybe a second question.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm writing a book about this now, and as it turns out. And so I could talk all day about the transition from, you know, workers are heroes to you need to go back to work no matter what at this shit wage is a pretty significant turn of events, I think, you know. And there was a moment when I think we all thought that the pandemic would open people's eyes to sort of the lives of ordinary working class folks, and it did for a while, but then that didn't necessarily translate into the kinds of things that might expect it to. Higher wages, better conditions, more time off, more childcare, more sick leave, stuff like that. There has been a small uptick in wages in the last, you know, 3 months, but it seems like it's still not enough, I guess.
Yeah. Or it might be like the tighter labor market for the moment is, and as it loosens up, what will happen? Will it go back?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's historically, like, we have seen after major sort of catastrophes, you know, after, this is very historical, but after the plague, after the 1918 Spanish flu, there were wage increases, and for all kinds of reasons. And it may be the case that people, you know, quote unquote, don't want to work anymore and simply won't work until wages get high enough. In which case, we'll see a sea change. If there's ways to force people back to work, as you said, the labor market loosens up, other things happen when Biden's policies erode, people are probably more likely to go back. But I think we're at this moment of reckoning where we really have to take stock of what we saw in April 2020. And remember that though the virus, the biological pandemic may be coming to a close in a lot of places, like Vermont, for example. I don't wear a mask when I go in some stores now, but nonetheless, like the poor working conditions that were there before are still there. And we still have that problem. It was a problem in 2019, it's a problem 2 years later. And so, and some of those things will only be resolved by workers getting more of what they want and deserve.
You mentioned in the book that meaningful work wasn't eroded by high wages. You said that meaning was introduced to make up for declining wages. And there's a good discussion around this movement to make jobs and work connect to identity. How, I guess, obviously I don't want you to recite the whole book, but I guess what's the knee jerk on that? As you know, today, I see so many folks trying to connect life, you know, meaning and identity to work as leaders.
Yeah. I think there's a lot to say about it. And that was the part of the book that I wrote first. Like that's what I wanted to write about. But it led me to something else, or led me to this broader picture, I guess. But from the meaningful stuff, I think I'm of two minds. On the one hand, if we have to work to survive, everyone deserves a chance to have a job that fits their skill sets and desires and strengths and fulfills them in some capacity. I have a job that does that, you know, and everybody should, most people do not. However, I also think that the sort of mandate to, you know, sort of take this job and love it or find meaning in what you do is a relatively new phenomenon in the history of American capitalism. You know, when I grew up, my grandfather was like, just get a job. He never said get a job you want, you know, get a job you like. It was like, go to community college and get a job. That was like success. And where I work now, that would be considered a failure from graduating seniors, right? Like they're only successful if they get a job that fulfills their emotional and sort of psychological and almost libidinal needs. And so I was interested in why that is. And I think that it has less to do with, you know, simple changing norms or simple, I think it has to do with the way that we produce goods and services. And a service economy inordinately links people more to working with other people, interacting with things, and interacting with high-level machinery, communicating with people all the time. And that kind of work necessarily requires more of the self and more input. And when we have more of that investment and input in our work, we're more likely to develop attachments to it. So I think like that cultural value to some extent stems from an economic process.
Gallup had a book that came out before the pandemic called It's the Manager, talking about a lot of stuff, but that, you know, employee engagement numbers are just bad. It's like without even quoting the percentages are just tough. And it seems like a lot of companies say the solution is job training. I wanted to get your feeling on where you think job training fits in and where is it maybe overhyped, especially because I think one of the stats mentioned only 37% of the 50 million new jobs that America will be adding by 2028 are going to require any education. Mm-hmm. So where can job training really play a role? Because there's got to be more to it.
Right. I mean, as to your point a minute ago, if you look at the fastest growing jobs that our economy will produce in the next 10, 15 years, there are a bunch of different ways of saying home health aide and nurse. You know, like those are the kind of jobs that we're making, and more on the lower wage caregiver side. You know, I think when we think of the future of work, we think of like either a robot or someone in some sort of gleaming office with like glass walls everywhere. And in fact, what we should picture is like a woman of color taking care of someone hanging on to Medicaid or something like that, you know, because that's the way the job production is going. As far as job training, I mean, as someone who runs a job training company, you probably know more about this than I do. But my, you know, I think for employee engagement, what people are looking for is some degree of autonomy and freedom and power on their job, even at the lower echelons of the labor market. Like, not only are low wage jobs keep you poor and they're undignified, but you have no control over what happens at work. Like, you know, in a job like mine, which, you know, my mentor called being a faculty member the last good job in America, because you have control of your time. Like, you have a lot of autonomy, and that more than anything else probably makes the job so desirable, and it keeps people sort of their eyes on the prize and keeps them engaged at work. So things that, you know, ways that managers can help facilitate that for people, I think helps engagement. Obviously, as we were just talking about, the other thing would be, it sounds crass, but like money. Like, good pay does keep people around, as far as I know anyway. And, you know, there's a chance, given the labor market today, I could be forced to do my job for a little bit less, but not for a lot less, you know? And I think there's a lot of people out there basically who are in that situation, who are working for far, far less than they should be. And no wonder turnover is so high. There's a danger of that also that we witnessed during the pandemic. And that is that when turnover is high among low-wage workers, you have people at nursing homes in direct competition with fast food joints. So it's like, we need fast food work. We need healthcare workers. And the last thing we need is them being like, oh, maybe I'll work at McDonald's because they pay a little bit more. And the job is probably a lot easier, you know, especially during the middle of COVID. So I think, like, we have, as a society, we have a real social stake in making workplaces places where people want to stay for a long time, like making professions out of a lot of what we think to be low-level jobs.
The last question I want to ask you, Jamie, is, you know, talking about future of work, what is your hope for the future of work?
My hope is that the pandemic provides us, that we take advantage of the opportunity the pandemic provides us, and that is to rewrite the rules of the labor market. And a just recovery from the pandemic is not back to normal. It's like a transition to a world in which ordinary people have more power on the job, and which the people who take care of us every day are well taken care of. And if we can learn that lesson from the pandemic and put it into action, that would be you know, it would be a minor miracle, but it would also be the right thing to do. And so my hope is that, you know, the people that are sort of visionary thinkers in the world of work that actually have capacity to make some changes are given room to do that. One way to do that would be to, you know, think historically and pass the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act, which, you know, after the Depression, you got the pendulum swung the other way and you got the New Deal. We need something like that. The future of work needs some sort of New Deal-like pendulum swing to protect workers and to empower them. And so that is my hope for where things go.
Jamie, it's great to meet you. Thanks for talking.
Good to meet you too. Thanks so much.
As a sociologist, labor activist, and union activist, Jamie has a unique perspective. and a perspective that we should tap into to make sure we're living in a reality as labor leaders every day, thinking about the lives of every worker we employ, every worker we lead, every worker that comes into our workforce. You know, in Jamie's book, he tells stories of people that have been nickeled and dimed by the labor market, effects that people have had to deal with, their families have had to deal with, things like their health, with their day-to-day financial decisions that they have to make because of the way that our labor market treats them. And while I urge you to pick up Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream, I'm sure you'll walk away with an understanding that when Jamie makes the comment that we need to rewrite the rules of the labor market, you'll understand that these are some things that we should do at the very least. There are many rules that aren't built for the future of work today, that aren't built with the worker in mind. Whether you're working in an Amazon warehouse, a fast food environment where you're carrying multiple jobs, a retail environment, you're living paycheck to paycheck. So many jobs in America aren't built on just the backs of workers. They're built on the time of low-wage workers. And the beautiful thing about any economy is the rules can all change if we decide to change them. So that's all we got for this episode of Bring It In. I highly encourage you to head on over to your local bookstore, pick up Jamie McCullum's book, Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream. I know he's got another book in the works. I'm not going to spoil that one for you, but keep your eye out. By the time you get done with Worked Over, maybe that next one will be out. Don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In. We've got a ton of other amazing guests on the way. And now, back to work.